An illegal action from Kamala Harris does not make an alien legal. That is not how this works.
Actually, it is how it works. It wasn't illegal, and it wasn't done by Kamala Harris. It was actually done by Donald Trump.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Other than that, you nailed it.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
J.D. Vance.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio, Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today as news continues to break. He called them what, Desi Doyen? He called himself Black Nazi? Is that right?
Yes.
Black Nazi.
Yes. That's not J.D. Vance you're talking about.
No,
that is Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson of North Carolina,
yes,
who is the GOP nominee for governor,
yes,
of North Carolina.
Yes, who called for bringing back black slavery more than 10 years ago, and a whole bunch of other lewd things on a porn site some years ago that, because this is a family show, I can't even report. But
classy stuff.
That's going on today as we go to air. There is a lot going on, and of course, it's going on all at once, from the stock market blowing up in a good way, I should say, following the Fed's larger than expected lowering of interest rates on Wednesday, signaling that out of control post-pandemic inflation is finally under control and back to normal levels, pre-pandemic levels under the management of the Biden-Harris administration, and back down to levels that are lower than any other industrialized nation in the world. On Thursday, the S&P and Dow both set record highs. And by the way, Donald Trump's failing media company on the very same day, which trades as DJT on the NASDAQ, fell to a record low, tumbling nearly 6% in one day, far below what the stock had actually been worth before it went public earlier this year. As I had long warned MAGA folks who were invested in that turkey to get out before it was too late. I also suggested, by the way, that it might be a penny stock before we even get to Election Day. And from a high of almost $80 a share earlier this year to an almost 80% plummet since then, to close at just $14.70 on Thursday. Well, my warning of it becoming a penny stock and becoming delisted actually may still come to pass before Election Day, if not far sooner. For those MAGA folks who listened to me to get out, you're welcome. For those who didn't, a sad trombone. From that to Israel's war against its neighbors, now threatening to spread into a full-blown regional conflict following weeks of rockets flying back and forth between Israel and Lebanon, and the horrific terror attack by Israel against Iranian-backed Hezbollah there this week, with the deadly remote-controlled explosions of pagers and walkie-talkies in Lebanon, to threats of escalation by both parties now, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seeks ways to continue Israel's unpopular wars, plural, at this point, so that he can stay in power and stay out of prison. From that to Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson's threat on behalf of Donald Trump to shut down the U.S. government by the end of this month if Democrats do not agree to a new law that would ban non-citizens from voting in U.S. elections, which sounds like a good idea, except that it is already unlawful for non-citizens to vote in U.S. elections. And even though Johnson this week was not even able to get his own party to go along with that scheme, as Congress barrels towards a shutdown that probably will not reflect well on Republicans should it happen, just before a presidential election when the entire House of Representatives, by the way, will be up for re-election. Keep that in mind. From that to Donald Trump and J.D. Vance continuing to terrorize the small city of Springfield, Ohio, with blatant racist lies about the legal Haitian immigrant population there, despite the town's Republican mayor begging Trump and Vance to knock it off as the city has come under siege from bomb threats to parades of Nazis and racist Proud Boys and flyers from the KKK distributed during a rally on Wednesday. Republican vice presidential candidate and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, when he was asked about his and Trump's continuous lies that, quote, illegal migrants had descended on the town of Springfield, where, by the way, local Republican officials had sought this influx of immigrants to revitalize the town, which was actually a success for the town, at least until Vance decided to attack his own Ohio constituents and Trump decided to play along to distract from his disastrous debate appearance against Kamala Harris last week, when Vance was finally called out for lying about the immigrants in Springfield being illegal by someone in the media. Now, we told you long ago that they were not illegal at all, as they were there under temporary protected status, or TPS, granted by, yes, the President of the United States, which now is Joe Biden, but initially included Donald Trump. 5 years ago, who granted this status? Vance admitted in this confrontation, I guess, with the journalist that he did not really care about telling the truth, that he was going to lie about the residents of his own state anyway, because apparently that is how desperate these guys must feel that they are in the race.
Hi, Senator. Mia McCarthy with Politico. Question for you about the Haitian migrants in Springfield. So I know you've talked a lot about how we need to deport illegal aliens, but I wanted to ask you, the majority of the Haitians in Springfield came under TPS, so they are here legally. And I know you've expressed a lot of your issues with the TPS program and wanting to change that under a Trump-Vance administration. But I guess my question for you is, if you become the vice president under a Trump administration, what will you guys do about the migrants that are already there, since they did arrive legally? And a follow-up to that, if you plan to deport them, how would you do that legally?
Well, look, this is a media and Kamala Harris fact check that I want to clarify and clear up right now. And now, the media loves to say that the Haitian migrants, hundreds of thousands of them, by the way, 20,000 in Springfield, but hundreds of thousands of them all across our country, they are here legally. And what they mean is that Kamala Harris used two separate programs, mass parole and temporary protective status. She used two programs to wave a wand and to say, we're not going to deport those people here. Well, if Kamala Harris waves the wand illegally and says these people are now here legally, I'm still going to call them an illegal alien. An illegal action from Kamala Harris does not make an alien legal. That is not how this works.
Actually, yes, that is exactly how it works. As I said at the top of the show, it wasn't illegal in the least. And it, by the way, it was not done by Kamala Harris, who is the vice president. It was done by the president, who is now Joe Biden, but who used to be, yes, Donald Trump, who initially granted the TPS temporary protected status 5 years ago. Anyway, great job on the fact check correction there, J.D. Vance. As I said, the mayor of Springfield, who is a Republican, is now begging for them to knock it off.
If you have the national stage and you're a national politician, please understand the words that you're saying have great weight and how they can negatively affect a community like Springfield, Ohio. We just ask that it would quiet down. We need help, not hate. We need peace.
Help, not hate. We need peace, says the Republican mayor of Springfield.
Yeah, and what J.D. Vance and Donald Trump are doing is straight out of the authoritarian playbook. You demonize one small group and get folks to say, yeah, I guess they're bad. And then you go to the next group and the next group and the next group.
Well, you notice how he said it's not just here in Springfield. It's all across the country that this is happening.
Yes.
Anyway, good note, Desi Doyen. How are you?
I'm good.
Okay, good.
Everything's going all at once,
good.
But,
that's
what
usual.
It is.
But that's how pathetic and desperate apparently these despicable people now are. And of course, those are the same folks that are pretending that non-citizens are voting by the millions in this year's elections. And therefore, we must purge hundreds of thousands from the voting rolls, just as voting has already begun in some states, despite any evidence of non-citizens voting in any states. But now I'm getting ahead of myself. So, of course, that's all just some of what is going on today. And it's all happening at once. And I suspect we're going to see a lot more of everything all happening at once between now and Election Day, which I call phase one of this year's election. And phase two, then, which is likely to kick into high gear after the close of polls on election night, particularly if Donald Trump appears to be the loser. But since so much of all of that and more is being affected or will be affected by what happens in this year's elections, I'll continue to focus on that today, by and large, including both the horse race and, as importantly, if not far more so, the track conditions on which the horses are running, including the future of democracy itself in these United States, which, yes, also hinges on the November elections. Oh, and not to mention the future of humanity itself as our climate crisis continues to wreak utter havoc all over the world, as Desi will remind us later in this hour in her latest Green News report.
You're welcome.
So allow me to start here with the horse race for a moment and those who are now attempting to game the track conditions on which those horses are running, since it seems to me that they may not care for the way the race appears to be going for them right now. A bunch of new polling came in over the past 24 hours just in Pennsylvania alone. At least six new polls from just overnight, along with several national polls from legit, decent quality outlets like Fox and New York Times Siena, though the latter, New York Times Siena, has been very right-leaning this cycle for some reason. TPM's Josh Marshall observes that from a 30,000-foot takeaway, these polls are telling a pretty good story for Harris. He sees more evidence that Harris is consolidating real leads across the blue wall states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and yes, Pennsylvania. Of those six Pennsylvania polls, he notes, three show a tie there. Still, the other three showed leads of 3, 4, and 5 points, respectively, for Harris over Trump. Across these results, you also see more signs of Harris consolidating or in some cases expanding on the 2020 Biden coalition, he says, especially with traditional Democratic constituencies. The gist, he says, is that Harris seems to be consolidating a small but significant lead based on the blue wall states while remaining close or tied in the southern tier states, where she may be better positioned, believe it or not, in North Carolina. And she may be positioned even better in North Carolina after the story about the Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who's running for governor there, that I mentioned at the top of the show. But North Carolina has gone to the Republicans over the last three elections. And the idea that it is even close at this point should tell all of us a lot about the direction this campaign is moving. But she may be better positioned in North Carolina than even in Georgia and possibly Arizona, both of which went to Biden in 2020 after decades ending up in the Republican column in presidential races. Now, I've discussed the blue wall strategy that Democrats are most focused on. That if they win Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, where polls show the Harris Walls ticket just slightly ahead of Trump Vance in all three of them, with the closest for now seemingly Pennsylvania, according to pre-election average polling averages. But if they hold those three, if they win those three and hold all of the other traditional blue states as expected, and by the way, if they can hold on to those states through the challenges and contests and gaming that Republicans will be attempting this year in the event that Trump loses, well, if they do that, then Harris and Walz will win the presidency, though just barely. While such a scenario would likely see Harris beating Trump by millions of votes in the popular vote, we do not choose our presidents, sadly, by popular vote. We choose them via a state-by-state electoral college vote, where the popular vote winner in each state wins all of the electoral votes from each of those states, and the ticket that wins 270 electoral college votes or more wins the White House. So that blue wall strategy, winning in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and all of the other traditional Democratic states, even if they win none of the other battleground states, well, that would net the Harris-Walz ticket exactly 270 votes. But only, and this is an important only if they win the one electoral college vote in Omaha, Nebraska, the second district of Nebraska. Nebraska is just one of two states in the union, along with Maine, that actually divvies up some of their electoral college votes by House district instead of winner take all. If the blue wall strategy works out, as Democrats hope, then they must win Nebraska's second congressional district in order to win the Electoral College with exactly 270 votes. Again, that assumes they don't win any of the other battleground states. So naturally, Republicans are hoping to try and, yes, steal in advance that one electoral vote in Omaha, Nebraska. How? Well, it's an effort being somewhat headed up by South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. So in one sense, if that clod has been dispatched to oversee this scheme, well, perhaps we shouldn't be too concerned about it.
But, well, I don't know.
But here's what NBC is reporting today. Senator Lindsey Graham met with Nebraska's Republican Governor Jim Pillen and about two dozen Republican state legislators to discuss how the state allocates its electoral votes, according to a source with direct knowledge of the trip. Graham, acting on behalf of the Trump campaign, was working to encourage Pillen to call a special legislative session in Nebraska at which lawmakers could consider changing the state's apportionment of electoral votes, the source said. So, yes, they want to change the way electoral votes will be divvied up between candidates in a presidential election less than 50 days before that presidential election, as some states have already begun voting in that election. And just about 10 days before Nebraska itself begins mail voting. So can they do that? Is that legal? Would the courts allow such a change even after voting has already begun? Well, of course, any such decision like that would almost certainly go up all the way to the corrupted, packed, and stolen right-wing extremist U.S. Supreme Court. So, yeah, I think we have to assume that the Roberts Court would, in fact, find a way to allow such a change if Nebraska Republicans could pull it off in a special legislative session. As NBC explains, the state allocates its electoral votes by congressional district. The swing district around Omaha often goes to the Democrats in an otherwise ruby red state. Now, in such a scenario, the one that has been in place for years, Nebraska, which has five electoral college votes, if the state votes as expected, Trump would win, likely win four of those votes. Harris would win just that one in the congressional district that includes Omaha and which has voted Democratic in presidential elections in recent years. So rather than try and, you know, win that district with popular policies that voters there may actually like, Republicans instead are now hoping to simply disenfranchise Omaha voters just days before the election actually begins there. Wednesday's meeting originally was reported by the local news outlet KOLN-TV. It took place in Lincoln, Nebraska. Graham's office confirmed the local report but did not decline to comment further. NBC notes that if Nebraska were to switch to a winner-take-all system, it would almost certainly give former President Donald Trump one extra electoral vote in what is expected to be a tight presidential race. That one electoral vote, says NBC, could prove decisive, as they explain then the Democrats' blue wall strategy. If Vice President Harris wins Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin but loses every other state, she and Trump would be tied at 269 electoral college votes apiece under a winner-take-all setup in Nebraska with Trump winning the state. So that's what Lindsey Graham is doing out there in Nebraska, hoping that we end up with a tied electoral college, 269 votes apiece. In that scenario, the race would be thrown to the U.S. House, where each state delegation gets one vote for president, and Republicans hold a majority of state delegations, and yes, they are favored to retain that majority, even if Democrats take back the overall House majority in November, as they hope. Nebraska's Governor Jim Pillen was reportedly, quote, receptive to Graham's overtures on Wednesday and indicated that he would, in fact, call a special session if he thought he had the votes to win in this issue. Pillen has previously expressed that sentiment. In fact, he pushed hard earlier this year during the regular session for lawmakers to change to a winner-take-all system. That was unsuccessful at the time. But last week in a statement, he said, quote, as I have consistently made clear, I strongly support statewide unity and joining 48 other states by awarding all five of our electoral college votes to the presidential candidate who wins the majority of Nebraskans' votes, he added. As I have also made clear, I'm willing to convene the legislature for a special session to fix this 30-year-old problem before the 2024 election. He added that he has not yet, quote, received the concrete and public indication that 33 state senators would in fact vote for that winner-take-all system. Supporters of the legislation have long said they do not yet have enough backing to overcome a procedural hurdle that has previously prevented that bill from passing. Trump, of course, has publicly pushed for the state to do so, to switch to a winner-take-all system, saying this year it would be, quote, right for Nebraska. Yes, it would be right for Nebraska. That's fun.
That's what he really, truly cares about.
The effort to move the state to winner-take-all, as NBC notes, failed this year. Now, all of that said, if this were to happen, if this actually were to happen, Des, you seemed a little worried. You got a little flush there as I was going through that story.
Well, yes, I am concerned because Republicans are trying to do the coup all over again.
Well, if they do it via Nebraska, don't get too freaked out over it just yet. Why? Well, because Democrats actually might have an ace in the hole to counter it if Republicans do that. As noted, Maine, state of Maine is the only other state that does not have a winner-take-all system for electoral votes. They, too, split up their votes based on congressional district, but Maine is generally controlled by Democrats. And though there is one Maine district that Republicans hope to win in that otherwise blue state, well, taking that one electoral vote from among the otherwise Democratic-leaning state, the Democratic state House majority leader there has said that the state, if this happens in Nebraska, that the state of Maine should then consider switching their system to a winner-take-all electoral vote system if needed in order to counter Nebraska if they change their system. So even if the Republicans are able to claw back one electoral vote in Nebraska, well, lawmakers in Maine may have a plan there to claw back a Republican vote in the great state of Maine. And again, all of this, if it were to happen, would require a whole bunch of things to all fall in line. First for Republicans, and then, of course, for Democrats in Maine to counter it, given that the corrupted courts cannot be counted on here to do anything but help out Donald Trump and the Republicans if they are asked to do so. And with Lindsey Graham heading up the effort for Team Trump, well, it's almost guaranteed to fail, it seems to me. What, Rudy Giuliani was not available for this? But I thought you should know about it, as it's one of those stories that, yes, could become really important in the days ahead. You know, like when we were trying to explain to you the importance of the joint session of Congress that happens on January 6th, way back in 2020, when few others were even discussing it in the media. Well, now you know about this one. I will say that in one sense, all of this seems to me to be a bit of a tell. A tell that Republicans do not feel particularly comfortable about success in their hopes of winning back the White House. It all kind of has the stench of loser all over it, it feels like to me, despite Donald Trump's consistent lies that he is certain they're going to win by a landslide, etc. So that kind of feels like desperation to me. So does this other scheme to game the Electoral College reportedly underway down in Georgia right now, according to The Guardian today. Neither of these, you know, speak too highly for the GOP's belief that they're actually think that they're going to win this year's election, at least legitimately, without finding some other way to steal it. Emails obtained by The Guardian reveal a behind-the-scenes network of county election officials throughout Georgia coordinating on policy and messaging to both call the results of November's election into question before a single vote is cast and push rules and procedures favored by the election denial movement, according to the independent nonprofit outlet The Guardian today. The emails were obtained by the watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, as a result of a public records request sent to David Hancock. He's an election denier and member of the Gwinnett County, Georgia Board of Elections, spanning a period beginning in January of this year. The communications, according to The Guardian, exposed the inner workings of a group that includes some of the most ardent supporters of the former president's election, of his election lies, as well as ongoing efforts to portray the coming election as beset with fraud. No votes have even occurred yet in Georgia, I should note, but the team, who is convinced that they are, I guess, convinced that they are about to lose, they've already decided, well, it's beset with fraud. The communications include correspondence from a who's who of Georgia election denialists, including officials with ties to prominent national groups such as the Tea Party Patriots. Had no idea they still existed, did you? The Tea Party Patriots. And the so-called Election Integrity Network, which is a group run by Cleta Mitchell, a former Trump attorney who acted as an advisor to the Trump White House during its failed attempt to steal the 2020 election. Cleta, you may remember, she was on that infamous phone call when Trump tried to muscle Georgia's Secretary of State to find him 11,870 votes, just one more than was needed to win the state that he had lost to Joe Biden that year. The group, which includes election officials from at least five counties, calls itself the Georgia Election Integrity Coalition. And this is about their conversations back and forth. One of the oldest emails from January, where they cite a story published by the United Tea Party of Georgia claiming that Georgia Democrats threaten Georgia election officials. The article was posted by an unnamed administrator of the website, but it turns out that he's part of this group. Quote, in what can only be seen as an attempt to intimidate election officials, the article begins, the Georgia Democratic Party sent a letter to individual county boards of election members threatening legal action unless they vote to certify upcoming elections, even if the board member has legitimate concerns about the results. The letter had been sent by a lawyer representing the Democratic Party of Georgia to county board members in Spalding, Cobb, and DeKalb counties. Election board members in each of those counties had refused to certify the results of local elections the previous November. In their letter, the Democrats sought to warn those officials that their duty to certify results was not discretionary. In an attempt to prevent further certification refusals, including in the upcoming presidential election. In response, the United Tea Party of Georgia took issue with that letter. They called it troubling, saying that it was Orwellian to demand that election officials certify an election even if they have unanswered questions about the vote. Well, there are always unanswered questions about the vote. But as far as the requirement to certify an election, that is not optional. Democrats and election experts have cited Georgia court cases dating back to 1899, dictating that certification is a ministerial job, not a discretionary one, that it is the duty of these county officials. At a gathering this week of state-level election officials from several swing states, right-hand man of Republican Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger warned county election officials that they could be taken to court if they refused to certify results in November. This group has been hearing from speakers of, you know, election deniers of all types from across Georgia over the past several months. Their letters go back and forth about that. The notes also discuss ongoing voter purges that Democrats have said are a violation of the National Voter Registration Act. Those emails also show how Hancock's initial response to the letter from Georgia Democrats warning county election officials that they have a legal duty to certify results. He said, quote, when you have a moment, this is a letter that he wrote to former election integrity advocate who's been on this show many times over the year, Garland Favorito. He's now turned into perhaps the state's most famous election denier. Hancock writes him a letter to say, when you have a moment, I'd really appreciate your opinion on this incredible letter from an attorney for the Democratic Party regarding voting to certify an election. He says, he asks, well, what do we do? If the Board of Elections has no choice but to certify an election, then why require them to vote to certify the election in the first place? Good question. But I might be able to answer that by saying that, you know, someone has to attest to the fact that, yes, these are the results of the election as tallied by the county in question. Whether they are right or wrong or perfect or have some sort of problem, well, that's for the courts to determine if someone wishes to file a case and challenge them. It is not for some political activist schmuck with no experience or expertise in elections who happened to wriggle his way onto a county board and hopes to use it to steal an election to try and decide It's just a matter of saying, yes, to the best of our knowledge, these are the results. These are the numbers we came up with. As far as we can tell, they are free from fraud. Here they are. And now we move it up the chain to the State Board of Elections and to the Secretary of State and so forth. And if you want to challenge it, take it to court.
But you have to certify it first, then you can go to court. That's just the steps that you take.
Well, that seems to be the law in any event in Georgia, even now. As noted, at least to me, all of this, trying to game the electoral count, in fact, all of this to me has the stench of loser written all over it. It is not about how to win an election. It is not about how to build a coalition. It's about how to avoid losing it. And that, to me, anyway, does not seem like a party with much confidence about its prospects. But, you know, the loser Donald Trump has figured out how to turn many of his many losses in life into wins before. So, anyway, no sleeping on all of this between now and the end of phase one of the election, between now and the close of polls on election night, and then likely until the end of phase two of the election. On either January 6th again, or perhaps, maybe even as likely at this point, on Inauguration Day on January 20th next year. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back with a bit more stench of losing and how democracy might work in an alternate world, you know, where everybody is allowed to freely participate, like the alternate world that we call out here, California. That's all straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You can mess with Texas, but don't you mess with me.
Okay. Let's mess with Texas. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. You know, I realize that the people who live in both of these states would probably slap me for saying as much, but California and Texas, Desi Doyen, you're from Texas.
Yes, I am.
You live in California.
Yes.
They're really not all that different. And they're both huge states, you know, lots of people, big economies, and well, maybe that's where it all, where the comparisons end right there. But I do know that when it comes to the way democracy works in each one, yeah, on that score, they could not be more different. With Democrats largely in control of most of the state of California, Republicans largely in control of most of the state of Texas. But in California, that one-party control doesn't show much sign of changing anytime in the near future, while in Texas, Republicans really do seem to be worried that, well, you know, if all of their voters actually get to vote in the state, that they may not be able to hold on to the power that they have managed to amass for themselves in the modern era. Again, kind of the stench of the loser, it seems to me. So anyway, we talked about this story, as it was developing a week or so ago in Texas, but Brad Blog legal contributor Ernie Canning picked up on a few new developments today in his report over at BradBlog.com. He notes that Republican Ken Paxton, the ethically challenged Texas Attorney General, and that's
putting it really mildly,
putting it very nicely, yeah, who recently paid nearly $300,000 in restitution to plea bargain his way out of a securities fraud indictment that had been pending since 2015. He's been impeached. He's being investigated by federal authorities. Anyway, he is vehemently opposed to the effort by state county election officials to encourage voter registration via the unsolicited mailing of voter registration forms to likely eligible voters. Paxton's effort at voter suppression, writes Ernie, in two of the Lone Star State's most populous and Democratic-leaning counties has now resulted this week in several lawsuits all at once. A suit in state court filed by Paxton against Bexar County, that's San Antonio, and two filed in federal court, one each by Bexar County and Travis County. Travis is Austin, charging that the attorney general is attempting to suppress the vote in violation of longstanding federal law. Now, as we discussed a week or so ago, both Bexar and Travis counties in Texas hired a nonpartisan firm to identify and reach out to eligible but unregistered voters by sending them voter registration forms for this year's election.
Including Republicans.
Yeah. Well, just anyone who was eligible in those counties. They didn't distinguish between Republicans and Democrats.
Exactly.
And this is in Texas, where, you know, this year, Democratic Congressman Colin Allred is challenging far-right Republican senator and Trump lackey Senator Ted Cruz in a state which has long been trending toward Democrats demographically and where state Republicans have long been doing their level best to prevent certain people in the state from being able to vote at all. On September 3, after Bexar County election officials refused to comply with Paxton's cease and desist demand that they stop reaching out to these potential new voters, the attorney general filed a complaint in state court seeking an injunction to prevent county officials from mailing out these voter registration forms. Paxton's request for a preliminary injunction was denied this week as moot after the county attorneys there advised the court that the target of the mailings, qualified individuals who recently moved to or within Bexar County, have received those forms already and perhaps have already returned them. So the court decided it was moot. Paxton has appealed. So the attorney general of the state is actually suing county election officials to prevent them from signing up new legal eligible voters in the state in advance of a presidential election. In turn now, on September 17, Bexar County filed its own complaint against Paxton, this time in federal court, alleging that the attorney general is engaging in illegal voter suppression in violation of the National Voter Registration Act, and that he has abused his power as attorney general by filing the state court lawsuit against them for simply mailing voter registrations to likely eligible voters.
Now, these are just voter registration applications.
Yeah, that's
they're
it.
Not ballots.
Yeah, no, they're just, hey,
this is just,
sign
hey.
Up to vote.
Yeah.
And you would still have to, you know, present legal ID
all
and all of
stuff.
That stuff. Yes. On the very same day, Travis County, which is home to the state's capital, they filed a similar suit in federal court against Paxton, charging that what he's doing is in violation of the Voting Rights Act by trying to prevent them from carrying out their duties to promote the right to vote. According to Bexar County, Bexar County's complaint, election officials, quote, have a duty under federal law to encourage voter registration in this manner. The dueling lawsuits, writes Ernie, come shortly after the Lone Star State's Republican Governor Greg Abbott proudly announced that nearly 1 million voters, people in Texas, had been recently purged from the voter rolls based upon, among other tenuous claims, a dubious allegation of widespread non-citizen voting in Texas, for which the governor provided zero evidence in support. According to Brennan Center for Justice, actual cases of non-citizen voting, which is already a felony punishable by jail time and deportation, such instances are vanishingly rare. As Ernie helpfully notes here, the deadline to register to vote in Texas for the upcoming election is October 7. He notes that if you think you're registered, given this massive purge in Texas and elsewhere, it would be a very good idea for you to check your registration status. So that's what's happening in Texas right now, with Republican state officials suing county election officials in the same state for doing their jobs and their duty as election officials, trying to prevent them from registering new legal voters in the state. By way of contrast, There's the great state of California, apparently on an entirely different planet at this point, at least when it comes to democracy. Here, the issue is not about preventing eligible voters from voting, but a question about how to expand what is already our version of automatic voter registration. As YouTuber and California resident Politics Girl explained in a video this week supporting SB 299, a measure passed by Democrats, waiting for a signature by the Democratic governor that would expand automatic voter registration in the state on the margins in a bill supported by a broad coalition of more than 140 grassroots democracy groups. Here's Politics Girl.
So I talk about national politics all the time. Obviously, the presidential election, keeping the Senate, flipping the House are essential right now. But I'm also a California resident. And what happens in California is important not only to me, but in many ways to the rest of the country. Because California is such a big state that it often leads the way in terms of legislation. We have such a huge population that if things are successful here, they can often find their way to the rest of the country. Which is why I think it's important to talk about the opportunity Governor Newsom has right now to sign into law something called Senate Bill 299. Right now, California has 4.7 million eligible but unregistered voters. That is the largest population of eligible but unregistered voters in the nation. To keep it in perspective, if these people were their own state, they would be the 25th largest state in the U.S. And I'm sure it won't surprise you to know that this group is disproportionately made up of historically marginalized groups. The thing is, voter registration was designed in the 1800s. And sadly, in a lot of cases, it was designed with the express purpose of making it hard for certain people to cast a ballot. The idea with SB 299 is that by improving California's voter registration system, we can show the nation that voting is not just a privilege, but a right for any citizen. And as voting rights are being attacked across the country, I think it's important that a state like California lead by example, that instead of putting up barriers, we take steps to make the ballot box accessible to all eligible voters. Now, to be clear, this isn't just about Democrats winning elections. If it was about solidifying the blue vote, the answer would be do nothing. California is already blue. This is about undoing the racist legacy of voter registration, and honestly, something we should all want. SB 299 would give the California Secretary of State the authority to upgrade the current partial automatic voter registration system. The California Secretary of State would have the power to make it so that when any eligible DMV customer declines to be registered to vote, they are still automatically added to a pre-approved voter list, streamlining the process, and in many cases, allowing pre-approved voters to activate their registration when they decide to, in many cases by simply appearing at the polls or by mailing in a ballot. With a pre-approved list, registration would be removed as a barrier for millions of eligible people. All they would need to do is choose whether or not they wanted to vote. And to clarify, eligibility to vote is verified through documents presented as part of the DMV procedures, like showing your U.S. passport or birth certificate. With all this talk of non-citizens voting, I want people to understand that this secure system would filter out customers if they provided the DMV with a green card or other documents that clearly establish them as non-citizens. This would secure our voting, but also protect any non-citizens from potentially serious immigration consequences if they made a mistake and tried to vote. Ultimately, SB 299 would bring millions more people onto the voter rolls. When a similar system was adopted in Colorado, it doubled the amount of people added at the DMV, with a huge impact on the 16 and 17-year-olds who were eligible for pre-registration. And because California's eligible but unregistered population is disproportionately made up of people of color, helping these people get registered means the voting population of the state would start to look more like California and less like, say, my family reunion. As a side note, SB 299 would also improve the existing registration process by automatically checking customers' registration status when they went to the DMV. Other states who have done this have shown that this more tailored experience results in not only more people registering to vote and more people updating their registration, but also an overall improvement in the accuracy of the voter files, which means our voter registration stays up to date and election mail is more likely to reach its destination. Finally, SB 299 will go a long way to helping previously incarcerated citizens regain their constitutional right to vote. Many people who have spent time in jail often decline registration because they're not sure if they're eligible. And this kind of program, like the one SB 299 is offering, would automatically verify their eligibility, so no one would have to worry about making a mistake. If you want more information on this bill, which if we do it correctly here, could be effectively rolled out to lots of other states, go to cademocracy.org/SB299 and check it out. This is the kind of thinking we need from our government. America is supposed to be a democratic nation, and a democratic nation should want to hear from its citizens. all of its citizens. And as citizens and voters ourselves, I think this is the kind of legislation that we really should be encouraging.
Okay, so that's the kind of thing we're doing out here in California.
Yeah.
But Texas, you go ahead and try and keep your voters from voting. We'll keep trying to help everyone vote here in California. Other than that, California and Texas, totally the same. More information at cademocracy.org/SB299. Green News Report is next on your broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. Okay, Desi Doyen, too much show, so let's get right to it. Our latest Green News Report.
It's quite worrying to see so many extreme events all over the world.
UN Weather Agency warns the world is not moving fast enough to avert climate chaos. North Carolina storm damage tops $7 billion. Plus, new study finds Biden's climate policies will save 200,000 lives from air pollution.
All of that life-saving news and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics analysis, and snarky comment.
Kamala Harris, you know, has always been for eliminating the combustion engine and mandating EVs. That's what she's been for her whole life. And it's crushed thousands of jobs in states like Michigan.
Wow, it's crushed thousands of jobs, and there isn't even a mandate yet. She must be very powerful. Are you frightened of her, Steve Scalise, GOP Majority House Leader? Because it kind of sounds like it. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, Kamala Harris is so strong, she is crushing jobs with just the power of her mind.
Yes, she is.
Impressive. What do you got for us today?
Well, first, good news for Phoenix. The city this week finally ended its historic streak of 113 consecutive days at or above 100 degrees. The streak began on Memorial Day and didn't end until 2 weeks after Labor Day, an astonishing 37 days longer than its previous record.
I'm sure everything's fine.
Globally, summer 2024 was the world's hottest summer on record, and a new data analysis from nonprofit Climate Central found that human-caused climate change made the extreme heat around the world at least 3 times more likely to occur. 1/4 of the world's population suffered through 30 days or more of intense heat. In the U.S., Americans this summer lived through an average of 20 more days of dangerous heat than in the past due to climate change. Extreme heat took the lives of more than 2,000 people in the U.S. over just the last year. In North Carolina, cleanup is underway from the unnamed tropical storm that spun up suddenly, unleashing deadly flooding. Preliminary estimates indicate it caused $7 billion in damage. The U.S. has now seen 21 extreme weather disasters so far this year that have racked up at least $1 billion in damage.
Wow, we ought to think about mandating EVs.
While Central Europe is still grappling with historic floods from an unprecedented storm, Portugal this week declared a state of emergency as more than 100 deadly wildfires rage out of control amid hot and dry conditions. Over in Brazil, the worst drought on record has lowered the Amazon River to all-time lows, and some tributaries have dried up completely. In Ecuador, the government will impose nighttime blackouts nationwide as the worst drought in decades curtails the country's hydroelectric plants. The European Union's head office on Wednesday warned that devastating floods in Southeast Asia, West Africa, and Europe Wildfires in Portugal, Peru, and the western U.S., and drought in a number of countries are combined proof of, quote, climate breakdown that it says will become the norm unless swift action is taken to shift away from fossil fuels that cause climate change.
But by all means, let's not take swift action. Am I right, Steve Scalise?
A new report from the UN's weather agency this week warns that governments must move faster and do more to avoid even worse impacts in coming decades. Their new projections indicate the world is likely to blow past Paris Climate Treaty targets and hit global warming of 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of this century.
Yikes.
To limit temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius, the report says greenhouse gas emissions must fall by 30% by 2030. Here's WMO science coordinator Lauren Stewart.
The message is really clear. The science tells us that we need to take urgent and ambitious mitigation and adaptation action. And we need to do this across scales, you know, from governments to the private sector to individuals as well. We all have an important role to play in reducing our emissions and also increasing resilience in local communities.
Well, for God's sakes, please, nobody tell the Republicans in the U.S. House, okay?
Finally, some better news. President Biden's suite of new rules limiting toxic pollution from cars, power plants, and industry will save 200,000 American lives from dangerous air pollution over coming decades. That's according to a new analysis by a group founded by retired EPA staff. Co-author Jeremy Simons, former EPA climate policy advisor, said, quote, "These are real people who would not be alive if not for the nonpartisan work of the EPA doing its job again after the last administration. However, they warned those clean air standards are likely to be overturned if Donald Trump wins the November election."
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Not going back. Not going back. Thank you very much, Dez. Yes. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other we have ever done, download them anytime for free at bradblog.com. That service is made possible by you. Yes, you. Those of you listeners who hit one of those donate buttons at bradblog.com or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. But I'm not going back.